Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And you can email us questions at foremanwolf@wypr.org if you have listener questions. We have a few questions to get to in a little bit. One thing I want to kind of go back to, we were talking about asparagus, which maybe you're not super excited about. I know some people have childhood issues. I know many people get over that, though, which is really great. One thing it's because of the bitter flavors. And one of the things about that dish that you were talking about from Tour d'Argent that's so great, and one of the things is I love bitter flavors, especially loving Italian food. It's one of those things, it's a balancing point in that cooking. And that dish, you have the strong vegetable flavor, you have the fat and the richness in the dish, but you also have the bitter orange peel, you know, and the aromatics of that, and you have the salty caviar. And it's all of those different points on the palate at the same time. That's why that dish is so special.
Pretty special,
because everything's there's a tension from contrast in all those different directions at one time. It's kind of the same thing that you do in balancing wine with asparagus. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But any other favorite asparagus recipes you want to get into? You were talking about using the stems or some of the ends for
to make
soup.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the parts that maybe are not quite as desirable for a main plate asparagus dish, but.
Anytime you're making a green soup, you want to make your soup base, as we'll call it, first. So you would want to saute, and you really don't need much because you really want to celebrate the asparagus flavor.
When you say you don't need much, you don't need much quantity for the base of the soup?
No, you don't need much ingredient. You don't need very many ingredients going into it. We're not going to put a bunch of spices in here. We're not going to put bacon in here like I do in a lot of my soups. I mean, this is a very clean, natural, you know.
Wait, no bacon?
No bacon. Not this time. And no chicken stock. This should be vegetarian, really.
Okay.
All right. So we saute onions and shallots and butter. So small dice of both. And you don't need that much. I mean, let's say we're making soup for four people. And you're using four bunches of asparagus. And I would do probably half an onion and two shallots. Saute it gently in the butter. Do not allow it to color at all, so you're just letting it become translucent and sweet, and then add cream. I would add probably, for four people, I would add a quart and a half quart of cream to the pot, and salt and a little bit of pepper, and just let that soup base, as I call it, just let that work for probably 15 minutes even on low simmer, just so that the onion and the shallot have it and the seasoning has a chance to flavor the cream, and the cream actually reduces a tiny bit. So you're stirring it, staying on the bottom of the pot. You're doing it in a stainless steel pot, a heavy bottom pot, hopefully. And meanwhile, you have all these ends that you've cleaned up and absolutely have no dirt on them at all, because you would never want that in your soup. And you want to be very careful. I'd probably wash them even one more time just before I went in, and I would make sure there was no water left on them, well drained. And once your flavor is developed, you taste your cream to make sure you like the way it tastes. That has a nice amount of salt in it. Drop in the asparagus. Cook it for all of about 2 minutes. And then immediately you should have your blender set up. And please, I would always warn you to be extremely careful whenever you're pureeing something hot in a blender. Do not overload that blender.
No.
It is very close to your face.
That is super dangerous.
It is highly dangerous.
And use a great big kitchen towel or something to hold that top on.
Yeah. Yes. Or if you're lucky enough to have a VitaPrep, which is a great, great blender. It's called the Chef's Power Tool. They're very, very expensive. But if you are able to have something like that, those are nice because they have air vents in. So it's much easier to puree something that's hot. But you would just go ahead and puree that until
you also maybe take it off the stove for a few minutes, let it cool off a little bit.
Sure, sure.
The flavor is going to kind of set in with.
I just don't want you to lose the color. That's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't let it sit for more than a couple of minutes. Unless you don't care about the color, but of course you do. You want it to be this beautiful green color that asparagus is naturally, and that's why you're not overcooking it, and that's why you're not going to let it sit too long. And then you're going to shock it in an ice bath. Once you puree that soup, you're going to strain it because, of course, there's a lot of fiber in the asparagus, and you need to strain that out. So a very fine sieve, we call a chinois in the restaurant, or a hand sieve that you might have that has a fine mesh to it, pass it through, and you may have to push it through. Just make sure that you're not pushing any of that fiber through. You may want to strain that soup a second time, which is what I would do. Check it for seasoning, and then if you're not eating it right away, go ahead and put it into a container and ice it down so that it cools down immediately, and then store it in your refrigerator and serve it when you're ready to.
The cool thing about that kind of a soup, because it's such a strong sort of base note of flavor, is that you can use all kinds of things as garnishes and contrast show off that flavor. So a couple of favorites?
One of mine is strawberry jelly, which is so pretty. And really would be fun for you to, you know, if you...
Is it something really sweet or just a little bit sweet?
No, I wouldn't put any sugar in it at all. I would puree strawberries again, and I would cook them, actually. I would cook the strawberries very quickly in just a little bit of water, puree them in the blender, strain them, add a little bit of gelatin, and just lay it out in a thin pan and refrigerate it. And then you just cut into little cubes. You can chop it up, and then you can put that on top of the soup. Or the egg yolk that we were talking about before would be a beautiful garnish. Or actually one of my favorites, I love cheese with asparagus. So either the crumbled goat's cheese on top or Stilton is one of my all-time favorites. I love Stilton. And a little bit of brioche or some sort of really nice white bread crouton, something fine that you just cut into a small dice or a brunoise and sautéed in a little bit of butter to brown and put that on top of the soup. That's buttery. It's wonderful. So they're, what would you suggest?
Bitter things, you know me. Mm-hmm. That's I'm going to want toasted pine nuts or you know, toasted chopped hazelnuts or a combination of or like green almonds if you can get them can be amazing or Reggiano honestly is about as easy about a combination of Reggiano that's just very finely chopped or grated on the soup and a little bit of that breadcrumb.
You can microplane it if you have a microplane.
Terrific.
Microplanes are great tools because you can just I don't know. There's something about getting a grater out to me that seems traumatic.
A microplane is sort of like a bit of a wand that you can rub something on.
Whip that thing out and, grate and put it away. You know, wipe it off and put it away. It just seems so easy.
A box grater does seem like it's 50 years
ago. I don't know what it is about box graters. But anyway, so asparagus soup is wonderful. And, you know, that can be the focal point of your lunch.
Yeah.
Easily. Dinner, maybe first course. If you're having a party, I love to pass, and I probably said this a million times, but I love to pass soup and espresso cups for an hors d'oeuvre. It's just such a wonderful way for people to eat something. They don't need a fork. They can just drink it while they're standing around at a cocktail party, and that would be very pretty. But you'd have to watch your wine with that. So why don't you tell us about the wine
I was going to say, what do you think is the worst thing you could ever drink? You've certainly tasted an awful lot of good wine and drunk a lot of good wine.
Mm-hmm.
What is about the worst thing you can imagine with asparagus?
Chardonnay?
It can be tough. I mean, just think about the principal flavors that you get in the wines. And Chardonnay can
did
be
I
tough.
Did I say that with a question mark behind it?
Series of question marks. No.
Yeah,
no
it,
need
it
to
is
be.
Chardonnay,
you,
right?
You should only really be scared if you're trying to have like Cabernet or Merlot or something like that with it. Anything that has green vegetable, like a red wine that has green vegetable flavors.
That would be
flavors.
Horrifying.
Right.
That would be horrifying.
Almost any red, is going to be horrendous.
Yeah.
Red wines that have like green vegetable flavors like Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot, Cabernet Franc, those flavors would be heightened. So really, we like drinking a glass of pickled asparagus, which would be a little bit tough with asparagus.
What do you suggest?
The two places I go to, the first thing I go to is almost always Suave. And Suave is a growing zone from the Veneto that near Verona. And that area is famous for a grape Garganaga. And it's a grape that gets really nicely ripe, so you get a real big fruit expression. But the other flavor of it is kind of bitter and kind of nutty. It's almost like an almond flavor. And that ripe and sunny fruit and sort of bitter balance, that is exactly what is successful with asparagus as a flavor.
So Suave.
And there are simple bottlings, there are richer bottlings. What you don't want is a lot of oak. Think about it. Oak barrels, when they're used to flavor wines, like you mentioned Chardonnay, I immediately think of oak. There are Chardonnay that you could have with it, maybe very high-toned Chablis or Champagne that's Chardonnay only that has no oak influence.
Okay.
That's very like mineral, almost saline. That could be attractive with it. But what you don't want is something that's going to be like, think about like tropical fruit. Think about vanillin, which is what one of the big flavoring agents that comes out of oak that influences Chardonnay or other wines. Vanilla and asparagus just doesn't. Yeah, that's it's really hard to imagine that being successful.
Right. What about Viognier?
Viognier probably also on my really short list of horrendous things.
That's what I was thinking, and it's almost what I said when I said Chardonnay, because I don't like the Viognier varietal that much anyway.
It is like exotic fruit and almost like oily tropical fruit.
Exactly.
And there's a certain, like, there's exactly the application for it.
I think that would be horrible with asparagus.
And this is exactly not the application for it.
Yeah, that's what came to mind first. Yes, okay, got it.
No question. Yeah, you always do get a little bit scared when I ask you about what is the worst.
I know.
What is the worst XXX, you know, that you've ever.
Right.
So anyway, all right. So what is the worst knife that we wanted to talk about knives a little bit today?
What is the worst knife
you've ever owned? Like the knife that you own that you're like, why did I buy this?
Okay, I've never had a knife that was the worst one that I own. But my mother used to have a serrated knife that was this long, what she called a bread knife.
Serrated knives are dangerous. I swear she had
for like 25 or 100 years. I don't know. And oh, I hated that knife. Even when I was a kid and I didn't cook, I hated that knife. Everything should be handleable. Everything should feel good in your hand. It should have a good balance. It shouldn't be too, you know, I'm a woman. I have small hands. I don't need a big knife in my hand. And I also, frankly, something that is a smooth handle. I have an Asian knife that has copper in the blade, and it is one of the most amazing knives I've ever owned, and it has become my favorite. And when I first started cooking, which would have been in 1984, there were no Asian knives available on the market. That no one ever talked about Asian knives.
It was all German knives.
It was all German. It was all Henkel, and eventually Wusthof became really, really popular. So my first set of knives when I did my apprenticeship was, a chef's knife, and it was an 8-inch. I rarely use a 10-inch chef's knife. It's the blade is too big for me, and I don't really see a whole lot of use unless I'm cutting into a very large piece of meat, and then I'm probably using a scimitar blade. So if I'm cutting a ribeye or something, I'm definitely, which is a blade that has a big curve to the edge of it and can handle a piece of meat like a large, even a ribeye with a big bone in it.
It can go through connective tissue and that kind of thing.
As well. And also, I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen a butcher handle a knife, but a butcher will handle a knife in a very different way than a cook will. And there's a reason for that, because they're doing a lot of boning out. And when you're boning out, you need a good boning knife that is, you need two. You need one that's hard and one that's flexible. And the flexible knife.
It's usually the sort of like long, narrow.
Exactly.
Sort of exactly. looks like you can conduct the symphony with it.
Exactly. And those knives are invaluable, but you really need to have both if you're going to really work with anything else.
If you're using a boning knife like that, the really long guys, incorrectly, you will snap that thing.
Right. Well, and the other thing, that's true. And that's with all knives. You need to be respectful of the knife and what its purpose is. As with the Asian knives, I mean, each knife almost has its purpose, which is amazing. You know, this one's for peeling carrots. This one's for, you know, daikon work or, you know, whatever. So, as a base set of knives, you would want a paring knife or a small bladed knife that you can do small work with. If you had any interest in learning how to tourner, a tourner knife is invaluable to help you tourner. And tourneying is one of my favorite things to do. And if any of my cooks are listening right now, they're all laughing.
Yoga for cooks.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I love to tourner.
Contemplative and physical at once.
Exactly. Yeah. It is contemplative, especially with potatoes, because tourneying a potato is so much fun.
It's one of the pleasant things.
It's easy.
Tourner.
It's easy to tourneye a potato because they're easy to tourneye. They're soft. They're perfect. Your
April Fool's joke for a cook is to give them a turnip and tell them to tourneye like
a
potato.
Or a parsnip. Parsnips are very weird because parsnips tend to be woody in the center and soft on the outside, or softer on the outside. So you have a paring knife, some sort of boning knife, if not two, a chef's knife, an 8-inch and maybe a 10-inch. And then if you are going to work with large pieces of meat, you want a scimitar blade. And then I highly suggest some sort of bread knife, some sort of serrated knife, but not one with a super long blade. Again, I think, you know, a 10-inch blade is fine, maybe 12-inch at the most.
There's like a little 5-inch serrated that I end up using that's very small all the time. That is fantastic, both as a bread. It's big enough to be a bread knife, but it's perfect for tomatoes, all different sized tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about working, and I always wonder about people when I go into the major stores and I start looking at knives and I think, wow, how do people handle these knives? Because you really have to be careful with them. There are a couple of things you need to think about. If you buy any of the Asian knives, a lot of their edges, except not global, but a lot of the other knives will chip in a heartbeat. That means if you don't use the proper cutting board, that means if you don't store it in a sheath, you should go ahead and spend the $5, $10, whatever it costs to buy the sheath, which are these little plastic guards for the knives. Go ahead and buy it if you don't have a proper
wood. Oh, if you throw it in the drawer and throw something on it,
forget
it. Yeah.
Forget it. You just might as well not ever buy those knives because they have to be stored properly. The blade has to be protected. And then you have to learn how to sharpen them. So not only do you have to have the right place to store them, but you have to learn how to sharpen them. And thanks to the internet, there are tons of different web, you know, or videos that you can watch. And I can't explain it to you. Each knife blade has a different edge. Each knife blade, some knives only have one edge. They don't have two edges. So it depends on the knife. You want to just look it up and find a video and then practice, because it takes some experience.
Now, you never work with Chinese cleavers. A lot of people at home like them because it's not hard to understand how to use a Chinese cleaver.
I don't use them. So, you know, but there's nothing wrong with using. I mean, you know, it's a good knife. It's just, I guess I don't like the boxiness of the edge. That's what it is. I don't like the shape of the blade.
Well, it doesn't give you a variety of different cuts. That's mm-hmm. the one thing you have to, for chopping and quick work, that kind of thing, and volume work can be great depending upon its size, but it doesn't give you a variety of cuts. Well, so it really kind of depends upon how sophisticated you want to be with your knife work. I think it's hard to get, unless you're a serious expert with one of those cleavers and have a great lead edge, which is that edge further away from you, mm-hmm. it's really hard to get sophisticated work unless you're very, very practiced with it.
Yeah, they're not fine.
It is,
knives.
However, easy to make a mistake.
Yes.
And to lose an entire finger if you're using a really big one because of the weight of those knives.
Please be very careful when you do buy a brand new knife. You know, if you don't have a lot of knife skills, please, it is the, and a serrated knife is absolutely the worst way to cut yourself. It is the most damaging. But getting back to stones and sharpening, you may need different stones. You do need different gauge stones, and you, just to quickly understand what a steel is for, is simply to hone the knife. So that's to take any little burrs or little things off the edge of a knife.
Won't
it is
really
not really to sharpen it.
It'll help retain the edge that you have, but it's not going to make it sharper.
It cleans up the blade.
The sort of last two safety tidbits. One, cutting boards. You're only talking about like hard rubber and wooden cutting boards,
absolutely.
Correct? The only really safe ones.
Absolutely.
Because your knives will actually bite into them. If you use a ceramic cutting board or a plastic cutting board or melamine, it's going to slide.
And you're going to hurt your knives as well.
And if you don't have some kind of a damp towel or something underneath your board,
absolutely.
When you put it on the counter, your board is going to slide, and then you can hurt yourself.
Right. So you need to stabilize the board with a damp towel. Okay, I use a kitchen towel.
Now we spent the last 5 minutes on being your parents and trying to keep you from cutting your fingers off. When we come back to Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine, we're going to leave the asparagus conversation. We're going to stop being mom and dad, and we're going to get into listener questions. Then we have a producer segment with Lisa Godfrey from Godfrey's Farm, a fantastic farm on the Eastern Shore that we get a ton of asparagus from and have for years.